Okay, to continue. We're talking about some characteristics of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next one is AA is essentially free. Okay, we're self-supporting through our own voluntary contributions. We don't demand that you put anything in the plate. If I'm your sponsor and you have a good job and I see you consistently stiff the plate, we're going to have a conversation. We're going to have a little come to Jesus meeting and. You know, but we don't have any money. AA doesn't have any money. You know, it wouldn't do us any good. All we ever do is fight over it. We just bicker about, you know, who's gonna get to control it. And we have Alcoholics Anonymous has an accounting firm that audits its books. And we have about, the last I knew about this, I have no idea what it is now because I haven't checked in several years and have no particular reason to, but the last I knew, we had about a $7 million prudent reserve. And so I hear a lot of people raising hell about why they have all that money, they don't need all that money, and blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out that the $7 million was not our idea. We told our auditing firm how we operate our enterprise. We don't owe any money. We don't make any bills. We don't have any of that stuff going on. They said, okay, to operate the way you want to operate, we recommend that you have about a $7 million prudent reserve. So it's not even our idea, you know. It's really hard to criticize AA. It's not all that hard to criticize individuals in AA. You know, if you pick us up one at a time, we're not all that fantastic, many of us, okay? But if you look at us collectively, you know, if you look at AA as a whole, we are just unbelievably brilliant and splendid. We are a bright, shining star in the affairs of men. We really are. So, we're debt-free, and we own no property, and that's the way we like it. And any group that I go to that is my home group at the end of every quarter or on a regularly scheduled period, we cut the treasury down to whatever our prudent reserve is, and we divvy it up according to AA guidelines consistently. Okay, in addition to routine alcoholics, we have unsocialized and unhousebroken barbarians. We have neurotics, psychotics, sociopaths, thieves, liars, cheats, all by their own admission. We have bleeding deacons. We have traditions lawyers. Every one of them are convinced that they represent the true spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every one of them are willing to die for their way. To our amazement, we care for each other. You know, we tolerate their ministry. We take a sincere interest in each other. We support each other. You know, alcoholism is an implacable foe. We wrestle with it together, hand in hand, or we die. So that's what we have to do. We just have to do that, or it'll kill us. So. Can it possibly be surprising that our code is love and tolerance? It has to be. Because, you know, especially when we're newer, we're not the easiest people in the world to love. I got a string of them laying dead on the path back there that would have attested to that had they still be alive. Okay, we also have an astonishing willingness to practice law, medicine, psychotherapy, pharmacology, and many other professions for which we have no credentials and no education. We feel like it is our responsibility to advise you on whether or not you qualify for the term sober, depending on what some well-meaning doctor may have carelessly prescribed for you, you know, or to control seizures or something. I mean, a true case, I had a very good friend in Alcoholics Anonymous named David Aronofsky, and he is now dead, but he went to a group called the Preston Group in Dallas, Texas, And he, they had a lady in that group who had been in an extremely bad car accident. She had head trauma. She recovered from that and became sober. Got into Alcoholics Anonymous, got sober, and her doctor had her on phenobarbital to control seizures. And some well-meaning people, a couple of guys in AA, one 3 years sober, one 5 years sober, told her if she took those that drug, phenobarbital, that she could not be she could not consider herself sober. And wanting to be sober more than anything, she quit taking it. She had a seizure and she died. And that is a true story. So, you know, that's why I said earlier, what you take is between you and your doctor. I don't have a degree. I'm not a doctor. I don't have a medical degree. So, you know, if you have physical or psychotic infirmaries, that's between you and your doc. We have an ad hoc self-appointed internal group that I call the Rules Enforcement Authority. They make sure that every little agreement that was ever made in any business meeting since the beginning of time is carefully codified and enforced. And, you know, trying to enforce a bunch of silly rules in the midst of a group of drunks is roughly like trying to herd cats. I mean, it's just not going to happen. It is not going to happen, you know. I mean, who do you think you are? You're the seat police. I see. Oh, I saved one too many seats. Well, you know what you can do, pal? I mean, if you like fights, you know, go enforce those rules. See what you can do. And what allows all this to happen? What allows something like an international conference to come off? You ever been to an international? Montreal, Toronto, Seattle, the latest one was in San Antonio. All you see are big blue badges. And you see tens of thousands of alcoholics in stadiums and on streets and in meetings walking around with a grin they cannot get off their face. I mean, it's like somebody painted it on, and they just laugh and they hug each other and they yell, and just, it's incredible. I mean, the joy and the happiness at an international is contagious and indescribable. I mean, it is just there. And you see things that will just make tears flow down your face. I see a guy coming in at the flag ceremony on Thursday night, a guy coming in from Iran with the flag of Iran, and right behind him comes a guy from Israel with the flag of Israel. I don't know where on this planet, besides an AA international conference, you can get people like that back-to-back presenting the flags of their countries and not... And both of them smiling. I mean, that's how we are. And so that is really some characteristics of AA that say, here is what our traditions have allowed us to do. We don't write letters anymore to Mrs. Irma L. and telling her that her membership has been terminated. We just say, come on, Irma, how you doing? How's your dog? Yeah. So that's why we have a dog. We used to have a guy that came to our group. His name is Ray Monster Tiger. And he used to say, well, my wife Gloria and I practice the traditions in our relationship. And I'd been sober at that time about 15, 20 minutes. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? So a lot of us approach relationships and marriage and so forth as though it were some kind of game, you know, or as though it had a set of intellectual objectives to be achieved. You know, like you have to find your soulmate. You know, I'm out there looking for my soulmate. And so we think that the big objective is to find the right person. And that is exactly backward. The trick is to be the right person. What are you going to do if you have an image in your mind of exactly who your right person is? Weight, age, hair color, fragrance, clothing style, height. You got it down, exactly who your Mr. or Miss Wonderful is. If they come along right now and sit down beside you and you're not the right person, they're not going to stay. Duh. They're not going to stay. They're going to just keep on going. So the trick is to really be the right person. That is the trick in life. You know, not only in relationships of romance and so forth, but in life. So the question is, are you the right person? The question is, am I the right person? Do my attitude and my behavior and my appearance attract the kind of person I would like to have in my life to share my life with me? So, you know, I have a thing here that says, how would a truthful, full disclosure ad in the personal columns read if you were seeking a mate? For many alcoholics, it might go like this. Wanted, single male or female. Must be willing to tolerate slovenly, insensitive, lazy mate. Must cheerfully endure for long periods without interactive communication other than occasional grunts. Must happily accept constructive criticism regarding dress, personal habits, vocabulary, hygiene, driving, language, housekeeping, laundry methods, cooking, and clothes folding. Must remain calm and unflappable during loud, immature, sometimes crude and vulgar outbursts, and must quickly overlook and forget all threats and false bravado. Tolerance of poor hygiene and flatulence a plus. Yeah, it's a deal breaker. Our question then is this: Would you want to have a relationship with anybody that would even answer such an ad? Please. So what we have are a lot of things to overcome in the course of getting sober and staying sober and learning to be happy, joyous, and free. That is AA's wish for us. That is God's wish for us, that we be happy, joyous, and free. So, you know, we bring a lot of, we're towing a lot of baggage usually when we get here and when we decide our life is going to happen. You know, I gotta get out of the fixer-upper category and get into a good eligible for human companionship category. So, you know, we have a lot of things that we bring with us that we have to look at. You know, we have dysfunctional behavior from our family of origin. You know, I was molested when I was a little boy. Okay, I was sexually molested on the streets when I was a little boy, and people asked me, what effect do you think that had on you? I have no idea. How would I know? What would I be like today had that not happened? I mean, I can speculate for you. If you like speculation, I'm pretty good at it. I can do that. But that's all I have is speculation. I have no idea what effect that had on me. I know I didn't ever mention it again or tell a single solitary soul until I was 35 years old. But I knew somehow if I tell my parents, this is going to turn out to be my fault. Somehow this is going to be my fault. But in addition to dysfunctional behavior, we also have a lot of functional behavior that we may have to adjust and have to recognize. You know, don't go tell your wife you want her to make the spaghetti sauce like your mother used to. That's not a good strategy. Many of us have had emotional and mental abuse. You know, we've been told we're lazy or stupid or incompetent. You know, and that's where all the stuff comes from in our heads. You know, it's people tell us things like that. People ignore us. Okay, if you ignore somebody, there's a very famous experiment that was done with rhesus monkeys. Go look it up if you want to. You know, it says if you ignore me, if you don't touch me, if you ignore me, if you don't show that you are warm and loving and will take care of me and be kind to me when I'm a little kid, I'm going to grow up with problems. You know, I mean, I just am. And there's nothing intentional about it. It's just going to happen. So we have a lot of good habits and bad habits that we may have to adjust, you know, smoking, eating, whether or not we exercise, what we think about our health. We often have some fundamental fossilized attitudes, usually in the form of sweeping generalizations. I love sweeping generalizations. You can just peanut butter something over the entire planet. But especially about members of the opposite sex, you know, we have a lot of those. So, and a lot of those were planted by our well-meaning parents. I mean, you got to be careful when you start looking at things, because nobody meant, in most cases, nobody meant to hurt you. They were doing to you what was done to them. That's all. They didn't mean to hurt you. You know, some of them, most of them, in their own way, love you. They don't, I mean, there's an old man named Chuck C. who has long since been dead, but he said, you know, everybody's doing the best they can. If they could do better, they would. And see, that is one of the greatest things I know. You're not doing it to me. You're just doing it. You're just doing it. So things like this determine our nature as individuals, in the big book it says we become restless, irritable, and discontented. In the 12 and 12 it says it's a spiritual axiom that whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. Man, I hated that. Yeah. In the big book, it says selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, are the root of our problem. You know, I think selfishness and self-centeredness. I think after the last dong of the last ding-dong of the bell of doom has echoed from the last hill, the only sound that will be heard on planet Earth is some alcoholic somewhere saying, "What about me?" So, these are things that we need to know, okay? If you know that, if you know about yourself, anything you don't like about you, you are free to change. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship and everything we do here, you know, and you're not only free to change, you are encouraged to change, you know? Don't let me spend any more time than I have to spend being ignorant. Okay? I beg you. One of my wives, I don't remember which one. I used to think it was the first, but I think it may have been the third. Anyway, no, it was the first. She told me I was a bum lay. You know, why would you let me go 14 years and never tell me that? Do you think I was doing that because I thought it was cute? You know, do you think I that was some kind of strategy I had? Why would you do that? If you thought that, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you say something? Who the hell would have ever taught me how to be anything but the way I am? You know, I didn't think this over and decide this was a good way to be. So my invitation to everybody in my life, especially people in AA, is don't let me be ignorant. Tell me if I'm doing something wrong, or if I have some bad ideas, or if I'm screwing up my life. You know, tell me. Don't let me walk around being a dummy. Am I going to get mad? Well, so I don't think so. Not anymore. There was a time I may have, but you know, care enough about me to risk my anger. I'll love you for it. I may not love you today for it, but I will tomorrow. So I have a series of things here that I'm gonna go over, and this is a question: who hurts whom? Who hurts whom? And So I'm going to read these to you, okay? Men hurt women with coldness and disconnection. Women hurt men with their hot emotionalizing and constant need for intimacy. Men hurt women with their need for control and their inability to be wrong. Women hurt men by falsely going along with what he wants. Thus, she loses her identity and makes him feel responsible for everything. Men hurt women with their negativity, cynicism, and distrust of people and emotions. It's because they don't have any. Women hurt men with their relentless niceness, positive thinking, and naive optimism about people and problems. This makes them feel more insecure and responsible. Men hurt women with their aggressiveness and eruptive anger. Women hurt men with their fears and tears and helplessness and anxiety and insecurity and powerlessness. Men hurt women by looking at them as sex objects. Women hurt men by using sex for reward and control. Men hurt women with their resistance to making a commitment. Women hurt men by pressuring for intense involvement and commitment too early in the relationship, especially when they threaten to leave men if they don't get what they want. Men hurt women with their seeming insatiable greed for money and power. Women hurt men with their lack of planning and preparing for their future and their Pollyanna-ish belief that everything will work out for the best, which men see as making them responsible for everything. Men hurt women by harshly criticizing their competence. Women hurt men by viewing them as far stronger and more capable of dealing with life than they actually are, but later resenting them for not turning out that way. Men hurt women with their silences, lack of emotion, and withdrawal when there is a problem. Women hurt men by constantly pressuring them for openness, closeness, and involvement when they are least able to open up. Men hurt women with their analytic, logical, and mechanical approach to personal problems. Women hurt men by making irrational assertions and wild accusations and by making demands that seem unreasonable. Men and women alike are often victims of an unconscious, destructive cycle, and often it goes like this. Have you ever been dependent on someone? Horrible, isn't it? It makes you so vulnerable. It opens your chest and it opens up your heart, and it means that someone has found a way into you and can mess you up. You build up all these defenses. You build up a whole suit of armor so that nothing can hurt you. Then one stupid person, no different from any other stupid person, wanders into your stupid life. You give them a piece of you, they didn't ask for it, but your head gets the idea that they can fix you, so an insidious dependency sets in. Then you discover that dependency takes hostages. It gets inside you, it eats you out from the inside and leaves you crying in the darkness. It can really hurt, not just in the imagination, not just in the mind, it's a soul hurt. A real gets into your heart and shreds it pain. Unfortunately, many people are just unable to see their contribution to a relation's problems. They go from partner to partner, always thinking that things will get better. But if you can see your part in the pain, your own pain that you cause yourself, then you can change. You can stop doing that. The stuff that I just read is a testament to the way men and women don't understand the other's nature. It is an expectation that neither of them can meet. And it's all that stuff I read about waffles and spaghetti. You know? They're not people are not passing opinions. They are not passing judgment at all. It is in their nature to be that way. What are common complaints that you hear women make about men and men make about women? Consider that, I mean, and they're almost universal, you know. Men don't communicate. It is not in the nature of men to communicate the way women need to communicate. Not want to, need to. And men, you know, they can't. There's a structure that goes from your left to your right hemisphere, connects the two hemispheres of your brain. It's called the corpus callosum. And it is the way the two hemispheres of your brain communicate. In women, it is much bigger and has a lot more traffic. It's true. So there are physiological reasons why we are different. It's not the way we were raised or the way this or the way that. It is there are physiological differences that we're just different. And so if we can take the attitude, get away from right and wrong, but live comfortably with different, you know, the French have a saying, vive la différence. So Bill W. wrote a letter to the Grapevine on emotional sobriety, which speaks to unhealthy dependencies. It's called The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety, and it can be found in the book Language of the Heart. It is copyrighted, or I would include it in these notes, but it can be Googled or found at silkworth.net under AA History. And so now is the moment you have all been waiting for, the lovely and talented Miss Polly P.
My name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am also very, very excited to be married to David Pistol. And in a few days, we'll celebrate 31 years of marriage. And I will, you have heard Dave talk about it. It has not been, all, you know, rosy. It's been a rose garden, okay? It's been a lot of beautiful flowers and a lot of beautiful smells and a ton of little thorns all poked in there. And those of you who have known me throughout most of these years know that. But
ratting me out, huh?
Ratting him out. He says I'm ratting him out. But what has happened is that we're going to talk about this earlier, in that for Dave and I have always had the first tradition in our relationship. And when we got together, my AA sponsor was a man who had been a priest, and he ended up marrying his Asian sweetheart. He left the priesthood and married. And what he used to say about relationship, and this can be child, this your, you know, boss, employee, whatever. But what happens with relationship is just take a relationship, stick it in a room where there's no windows or doors. There's no way to escape and deal with it. And what has happened is that Dave and I have maintained the first tradition, which we wanted unity. We want this marriage. And that's how I feel about that today. I am willing to go to any lengths in order to preserve this marriage. And the D word is something we don't even talk about. And have I thought about it along the way? Oh, yes. But, you know, it's not something that you go there, because I'm the kind of person that just, sometimes it just gets so hard, I just want to throw up my hands and I just don't want to deal with it anymore. You know, you just go do your thing and I'll do my thing. I don't want to deal with it anymore. And but what happens is as the years have gone by, it's like sobriety. I am so grateful I have been willing to do the work that has been necessary to remain sober and have a beautiful life. I am so grateful. And if I did not do the work, I wouldn't get the results. And marriage or any other relationship is the same. And we're going to talk about, I'm going to share some relationships with my children. I think one of the greatest relationships that we first come when sobriety happens that we come together with is sponsor-sponsee. Because what happens is we're going to begin to have an honest relationship. And I need that relationship. Because you see, I don't need to tell my husband everything. Because if I were to tell him my thoughts and all of the stuff that I think about from time to time about him would be very harmful. So what happens is it's wonderful that I have a relationship I can bounce this stuff off of, so I don't have to end up hurting the person in my life who is the most important person. The absolutely most important person in my life is my husband, but he is not the only person. And a lot of times that's what we have to learn with each other, because I don't know what kind of alcoholic you are, but I am a very insecure alcoholic. So that means when he has certain relationships, I feel threatened. And when I have certain relationships, he feels threatened. So we have to learn how to work within this insecurity, the disease of alcoholism, and have a relationship on top of it. So I believe that's why in the 12 and 12 that it says that alcoholics are people who are incapable of having a true partnership with another human being. Now that's a huge statement. But that is an indication of who and what we are because of the disease we have, because we are so self-centered. Now I can appear to you to not be self-centered. I can be very nice. The big book calls that, or I'm not sure if it's the big book or the 12 and 12, I always forget, I always have to ask Michael those questions, is that I can manipulate through kindness. I know how to do that. And so my challenge in life is to not manipulate and to say what I mean what I say, but don't say it mean. So if there's any Al-Anons in here, then you're going to have heard that a lot. And so that's my challenge. When Karen was introducing us, she was talking about a workshop that I had done for the first time when we were at St. Simon's Island, and it was called Sexuality and Intimacy. Now, I am not going to get into detail the way I did it that workshop. It's not that I have any problems talking about sex. I think it's a fabulous subject. But it's just that we don't have the time to do. That was a whole weekend on it. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a little piece of it. And what happens is that hopefully through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to be clear about my sexuality. And one of the things that we all need to be clear about is our sexuality. A lot of people are in relationships and their sexuality is not true because they may either be homosexual or lesbians. And through the 12 steps, let's hope we find out who and what we are. So my sexuality and who I am is important. I personally am a heterosexual woman. I love men. I absolutely love men. I'm a little old now, so it's that's kind of tamed down some, but it was hot and furious and caused me a lot of problems a lot of my life. But today I know my sexuality, and I also know what I want in my life. And that is that I want to be the woman that I am who loves men, but I want to be faithful and true to one man. And that's what I want. That's what I want from what I have in my relationship. That's what I want. Intimacy. Intimacy has nothing to do with sex. Intimacy, if we just look at the word, is into me see. What I'm going to do is I'm going to allow you to see into me. And I have an intimacy with my husband. I have an intimacy with my sponsor and my sponsee, my friends. And some of my intimacies, as far as into all of me, my feelings, are probably more intimate than they are with my husband. Because I am more likely will speak to someone who I sponsor or who's a friend and say something that is far and away more about the soul of me than I will to my husband. But then I have an intimacy with my husband that I am willing, as far as my body and everything goes, for him to have all of me. And I can give that up because I love the name of this workshop, because I'm safe and protected. So what we're going to do is talk about that safe and protected, because that has everything to do with who I am and who I'm allowing you to see I am, is to be safe and protected. So let's just take a look at personal relationships are about loving. That's what it is. That's what I have done, is I'm in this relationship because I want to be loving to another person. I want that. It's what I want. Making love work sometimes is a challenge. It's a huge challenge, especially, in my opinion, for people like me, an alcoholic of my type. If ever there was a topic on which you could gather lots of opinions, it would be love. For some, love is a decision, cold and clear. For others, it is a feeling. If the feeling is not there, neither is love. For still others, it is a mystical experience of union and fulfillment. The hard, cold fact is that no matter what love means to your partner, if he or she does not experience that love, the relationship is in trouble. We can have widely different concepts about what food tastes good, but there is no question about whether or not a person is starving. For years, I've seen people in clinical situations trying to build or rebuild relationships without knowing the key factor, what their partners are asking of them. If I am to be present to another person in a meaningful way, I absolutely need to know what that person considers important emotional and spiritual food. Without this knowledge working, our relationship is like being in a boxing ring with a world champion and being blindfolded. Unlike the football coach who was more than ready for the Rose Bowl game, we often are not really ready to deal with something as important as our relationships. If I were to ask you to write down your partner's three most important needs or requests, what would they be? Try it, and then check with your partner and see if you're correct. Are you surprised that your responses are wide on the mark? Sometimes so wide that you don't even get a single one right? Yet, if we are so much in the dark about the felt needs of our mates, how can we be present to them? As we will soon discuss, building trust with others requires being present to them in ways that are significant to them. And trust is the central issue in all relationships. If I don't trust you, it's very difficult for me to give you me and let you be into me see if I don't trust you. So trust is huge. what group of people have a worse track record than alcoholics on trust? Because in some way, real or imagined, we have come here damaged by a disease called alcoholism, and our trust is damaged. So here we're going to get into relationships, and what we're doing is we're waiting all this time for somebody to give it to me. What are you going to do for me? When the deal is that in order to be loved, I have to give love. And what do we hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? You have to give it to keep it. All of it, what goes around comes around. All of these things that we learn in AA is all about. One of the things that I came into AA and I heard the saying, let us love you till you can love yourself. Well, let me tell you something. If I had been waiting to love myself to love another person, I'd still be waiting. Because that's not anything that comes easy for me. But when I love you and do for you, I feel loved. I can feel that love, because what happens is when I'm giving it, it's when I receive it. And there's another big book for those of you who may be Christian, but it's in all elements of spirituality and every walk of spirituality. It's not what I get, it's what I give. And when I give it, I get it back tenfold. So, isn't it amazing that what does it mean to me to be loved? What does it mean to my partner to be loved? And the name of this conference, Safe and Protected. The very first and most important thing that I need in this relationship is to feel safe. I don't need jewels and flowers and all of that. I need to feel like I'm safe. How many people are in relationships that they're not safe? They're afraid of being hit. They're afraid of being screamed at. They're afraid of being left and all of this rage. They're in these kinds of relationships. And, you know, many of us, I'm an alcoholic mom. I created that kind of environment for my children. They were not safe with me. They never knew whether I was going to blow or be good or be passed out or be present. They never knew. And for most of us, we come from that. We don't know how to be safe. So feeling safe has to do with the sensing of freedom from abuse. Other words, you're not going to hurt me. The minimal requirement is to the sense that I will not be hurt if I stay here with you. Now, I can do that. I can look at Dave and say, I need to feel safe with you. I need to know that you're not going to hurt me. Well, we had a safety issue, Dave and I did. When we were doing the psychotherapy stuff and we were on the fast track and we were looking for, you know, our inner child and all the stuff that we went after to search for many years ago, Dave was 10 years sober and I was 9 years sober. When we were deciding that we wanted 20 years of sobriety and 10 years. And so we were going to go find our inner child. I don't know if any of you have gone looking for yours, but what Dave and I found out is that we both can act like children. We have the emotions and reactions of a child. What we are desperately trying to do is be two adults. And somewhere in this old body is an adult. And the kid is still there. You know, as I say all the time, I am a roller coaster riding grandma. I love it. But the hardest thing I do is act like a grown-up. That's my most difficult thing. But we had this safety issue. And I know that none of you can believe this. Michael knows it without question. I am a kind of a volatile person. And I have mellowed as the years have gone by, but I have a short fuse. And one of the things that happened was that around about 9 or 10 years of sobriety, I had asked Dave, I found out that Dave had kept something from me. And it wasn't a big thing. It was just, you know, a bill, or he'd done something and spent some money, and from past experiences, he was afraid that I was going to get angry, and he didn't like my anger and all of that. And one of the things that he said to me, I said, you need to be honest with me. And I said, because when I find out that you're keeping things from me, I don't trust you. And so what he said to me is, Polly, I want to be honest with you, but I just can't trust your reaction. And your anger scares me. So thank God, in that moment, we had a more intimate conversation, more intimacy than if we had been making mad, hot love for 2 hours. We had an intimacy at that moment that was real. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to do the best I can, and I'm going to pray about it, and I'm going to look at my character defect of anger. But I still want to know the truth, even though I can't always guarantee my reaction. So we kind of made a pact about that we would tell each other the truth. And what happened was, is that Dave was not safe. And through the years, it has been very important to me to make sure, because so now I know, what does it take for my husband to be loved? He needs to feel safe. And what happened was, is that today, if something is going on and I'm angry and I've got a problem, I pick up my toolkit, my sobriety toolkit, and I use it. Because where is it most important is in my relationship with Dave. And I call my sponsor, or I call somebody I sponsor, or I call a friend, and I talk this over before I do it to the person I love the most, because they're not involved in it. They have no emotional connection to it. And then I discuss it with Dave, because then I can discuss it without harming him. Because what do I want the most out of my relationship? The most important thing for me is to be safe. I want to know that I'm safe, that I can trust you, that no matter what, that it's a, you know, that you're, that I'm safe with you and you're not going to hurt me. Defended. Being defended means having the sense that I am not alone against the world. This does not mean that your partner has to agree with you on everything, but it does mean that, agree or not, your partner won't turn against you or side with others in a disrespectful way. So what I can do is I can count on Dave defending me. Now, he's not going to defend bad behavior. But what I'm going to give you another example, because I think experience is the whole thing. And an experience is that many years ago, I was asked to speak in Akron. And I'm telling you, I was lit up. I was so excited that I was going to be speaking in Akron. And Dave and I are now flying to Akron, and there's a big, big storm, and we get dropped off in Chicago, and we're not going to get another plane, and we can't. I mean, it is a mess. The whole airport is a jillion people, and they're trying to move all these people around. And I'm standing at the American Airlines desk, and I am having a fit. Now, I'm on my way to Akron. Did anybody get that? And I am trying to get this lady to do for me what I want her to do. And Dave, what he does is he does not reprimand me in public or anything like that. What he calmly does is he says, Polly, right now at this moment, this is the only friend in the world we have that is going to get us out of Chicago. And thanks to him, I was able to instantly make amends to her and see that there was a whole backed up line of all these angry people, and I was contributing to that. Now, what happened is he did not agree with my behavior, but he defended me. You know, he stood there and he helped me. And this is what we need. I don't need to make my husband feel bad in public by putting him down. There's all kinds of ways we can lovingly do these things without putting people down and making them feel shamed. Where is the first feeling an alcoholic is going to go to when you criticize them? And my first AA sponsor used to say that you can take the truth and beat a person to death with it. And where are we going to go instantly if the truth is given to us without love? To shame. That feeling of shame. So it's important. So I know today that it's important that I feel defended, and Dave knows that. I need you to be there for me. The other is supported. Feeling supported means having the sense that your partner is offering you encouragement, not just coming to your side during the hard times, but helping you grow, dream, and become better than you already are in a non-competitive way. Support means that you don't have to compete with your partner, but will assist each other to be all that you can be. Now, again, experience. Dave and I could not be two more different than we are. We are absolutely two opposites that have attracted. Complete opposites. Dave is like, you know, he is a genius. You know, he like drunk, he passed a Mensa test. And I mean, I can't even go to school. I'm so afraid of school. And we are just totally different. Yet here we are together. I've often said we have one thing in common, AA. That's an important thing, but that's what we have in common is AA. Pardon me?
Flea bags.
We have flea bags. We call our two little Shih Tzus flea bags. And we love our puppies. So, but we don't have, you know, we don't have anything in common. And some things have changed a little bit through the years because now we're a little older, and so things are a little different. But one of the things that had happened to me fairly early in sobriety is that I fell in love with women. And I don't mean in a lesbian way. I just fell in love with women. I love to work with women. It's the thing I love the most. And so I have a lot of women in my life, and I'm on the phone all the time, and I'm talking. And that could look like I'm not paying any attention to Dave. The other thing is that I've had the gift of gab. For whatever reason, God gave me the gift of gab. And I've been asked to speak around for over 20 years now, about 25 years, 26 years, 25 years. And I've been traveling a lot, which means I'm gone on weekends and my husband is home alone taking care of the puppies. And Dave was a backpacker and a rock climber, and I can assure you that none of that stuff interests me. I mean, black and white TV and slow room service is roughing it for me. I mean, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go do what you do in the woods. Ugh, just not my thing. But what happened is we support each other. And not too long ago, more experience. I was really on a run. I mean, I was gone like every weekend, and maybe I had a sponsee at some of the places I was at, so I would stay an extra day so I could be with them. And I mean, I just wasn't home for a long run. And Dave looked at me and he said, "Well, I get lonesome when you're gone so much. Well, what do? I jump to, well, I'm just going to have to quit doing that, and I'm going to have to quit traveling." And Dave says, "Hold on. That's not what I meant. I'm just telling you how I feel when you're not around because I love you. I don't ever want you to stop doing what you're doing because that makes you who and what you are. And that's what I love. I'm just telling." So he was supporting me, but he was telling me the truth at the same time. And I need that. And Dave says that he needs that. And what happened to us in around the mid-90s is Dave lost his job and really didn't work in his field again for 2 years. It was an economy much like this in Southern California. And we lost our home and had to file bankruptcy and doing a lot of the stuff that people are doing now. And what happened was, is Dave said, "I cannot believe how you supported me. When you never, ever got angry at me, you never said anything, I will always be grateful for the support you gave me." And when he would go on backpacking trips, you know, for long lengths of time, and he said, "You always encourage me to do that." Well, another thing, when it says, "What does your mate need?" I know my mate needs to be supported. And so do I. See, that's an important characteristic. That's important to me. Now, if I'm going to get what I need, I better give it. And that's what we're learning here, is whatever it is I need to give it to make sure. And the more important it is to me, the more I need to give it. Belonging. Belonging means being included, believing that you are important even to your partner, important enough to your partner to feel that you are part of a team. This often has to do with the inner realities, the sense that you want your partner to admit you into his or her inner world where you can share dreams, feelings, thoughts, and hidden hurts without fear of ridicule or betrayal. Huge. This is a huge thing for me to feel loved. And what I have learned through the years, it's huge for Dave. To feel like you want me here. I belong here. I share. We're gonna share the finances. Both of us, since we've been in this marriage, right up until we retired, but which we are still now equal contributors into our household, we have been both employed, both contributing to the household. So what has happened is we have both been involved in our finances. In other words, at different times throughout our marriage, I paid the bills. And then Dave paid the bills. So that has been something that has gone on, you know, that we have both done throughout our marriage. Not too long ago, Dave and I moved to Florida. And my speaking schedule was so heavy that I could not go to Florida with Dave to find us a place to live. And somebody said, "Do you mean that you're going to let your husband go find you a place to live with you and he's going to buy it sight unseen to you?" I said, "Absolutely. Absolutely. Because Dave and I know, because we have a belonging in this relationship, what we want. And I can tell you right now, I could not be happier with the place that he chose for us. Well, he built us a home in Birch Bay, Washington, while I was still working in California. And I can tell you, it is absolutely still the home of my dreams. And I am so grateful I got to live 7 years there. It was the home of my dreams. And I'm so grateful for that. So, of course, I mean, we have this sense of belonging. We know we're in this relationship. We know. And I knew that he would fulfill that. Cared about. Feeling cared about is the same as feeling nurtured, which means being told through certain actions or events, all the way from the giving of inexpensive cards to being held to making affectionate love, that you accompany an important place in your partner's life. That's all I want to be. You know, I used to think I needed money, men, and mansions. And now what I know is what I need is I need to be in a partnership and be cared about. And I need to be cared about in that partnership. It's important to me for Dave to tell me I look good. It's important to him. I mean, we prance around in front of each other like teenagers. What do you think? You know, these are important things that we need. And so I know that. So when he's getting all dialed up and I can see him pass the mirror and then he passes the mirror again, I'm like, boy, you look great. You know, 2 seconds at the most it takes to say that. And a lot of times people will say, well, he knows I feel that way anyway. Doesn't matter. We need to say it. We need to verbalize it. We need to show it. We need to let people know that they're important, to say, oh my God, I love you so much, and I need that. I just absolutely need that. And if I don't get it, you know, a lot of times I'm bellying up to him and I'm saying, you still love me? You know, you haven't quite said it enough to make the quota. So I need you to do it a little bit more. So it's important. And I need to feel cared about, and so does he. So what I try to do is I try to continue to give that because I need that myself. Accept it. Feeling accepted, which people seem to place enormous value on, means not being prodded by your partner to be other than, different than, or better than you are. All I want you to do is accept me just the way I am. Now, whether we realize it or not, Dave and I we started off, and this happens to any long relationship. If you've been in it from when you were 100 pounds, no wrinkles, cutest thing you ever saw, to everything's gone south, and the wrinkles have come, the hair's turned gray, and all of this has, you know, stuff has happened. Now, what happens inside, though, is I don't feel any different than I did when I was the cute little redhead running around in a halter and cutoffs, you know, and all the stuff I was doing back then. I still am that person inside. So I need to be accepted and cherished, wrinkled, sagging, and fatter, just like I was before. But so does he, because inside, he's still a stud. That's who we are. I mean, even though we've got these old bodies, we feel like 20 inside. So those of you who are young don't know that. But there's a few of us are sitting here that know that, that's how we feel. And so it's important that I still be accepted and I still be treated like that young woman that I was when we got married. I need to still have that acceptance and not have to worry, are you going to throw me over for a newer model? Because whether we like it or not, that's a common practice in our society. Whether we like it or not, it is a very common problem. So I can get into fear about that because I think my guy is the cutest, the best. I still feel that way about Dave. I still, when he walks through the door, he's still the one that makes my heart patter. And if I feel like that, I feel like all the other young chicks feel that way too. So what I could be doing is I could be creating a lot of jealousy and all that stuff that would rot away my relationship. So what I have to do is continue to accept my husband for who and what he is, because that's what I want from him. So if I want it, I have to give it. And last of all, I need to feel special. And probably for me, I think that is the most important thing, is that I feel like I am special to my husband. I want to be special. And I'll tell you another thing. I am the mother of sons. And what I am so grateful is that both of my sons think I'm so special. And I love it. I absolutely love it. So what do? I make them feel special. Because it's important to me to feel special, especially in the relationships that take all of my heart and soul. All of my heart and soul. And that's with my children, my grandchildren, my husband. And then it goes to my sponsors, sponsees, and friends. All of those relationships. So if I give that away, by giving it away, I feel it the best. I can feel more special by telling you how special you are. That gives me a sense of feeling more special, even though, in fact, sometimes more than if you're telling me I'm special. I feel it if I'm doing it for you. So it's that same thing. Whatever I give out is what I get back. Ten more minutes. Okay. I'm almost done. Once you know, good stuff. Thank you, Glenn. Once you know what love means to your partner as a practical, experimental matter, you're in a position to study the second question. What does it take for your partner to feel loved? And so what happens is that what we're going to do, what this all boils down to, is that I give you what I feel I need, and I'll get that back, and vice versa. It's the same thing we've done in AA. I don't know about any of you, but I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 3 years of my sobriety and hit a bottom more devastating almost than the bottom between alcohol and drugs behind relationships and sex. All because I thought if you'd love me enough, I'd be okay. And it never was about you loving me. It was always about me loving you. So the bottom line is the more I give, the more I get. The same philosophy that works, AA works in every single area of my life, because it is a spiritual axiom. What I give away is what I get back. Always. What I give is what I get. Okie doke. That's it.
Okay.
Is it lunchtime? So what do you want to do? It's 10 minutes to 12.
It's lunchtime.
So plan.
Okay.
Anybody have any questions from the audience?
Yeah, right. We got what? How many minutes do we?
I have not
turned it all the way on. Sorry.
Does anyone have a question for Polly and Dave about anything from this morning? 5-10 minutes in the audience?
God, I have some questions here.
So thorough.
You did a great job. You know, when Polly and Dave were speaking, I remember when we had this workshop down in Georgia, and my first time that I met Polly in person, and this deal with intimacy was such a huge jump, and I wasn't good at it. And Polly, when you were, and Dave were talking this morning, I remembered a story about my own mom. You know, and she stood there one night. She looked smashing. My mother was a beautiful woman. She was smashing. And I said, "Oh, Ma, you look great tonight." She said, "You know, I'd love your father to say that." And you know how we repeat what we know. And that's what we bring in. And when we went down this workshop, Polly and Michael brought up a whole lot of questioning. Is that what happened? How do you feel? What was your truth? And it was kind of like in the opening story of tell me your story, where Michael always says, tell me about your mother. Mm-hmm. And then you'll learn my story. I learned my story. So what this did for me when I heard it the first time and continue to hear it is that being taught to love me helps me to love you, and in many different ways. And I just so appreciate what you brought to us this morning. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, does anyone have a question or do you want to ask? I think we're stunned. Okay. There are several places to have rest. That was me. Here, take that away.
So
there's restaurants here. There's restaurants in the area. The front desk can probably help you. You know, we'll break till 1:30 and then return, okay?